Houston, Texas, is Dr. Gerald Horn. And Dr. Gerald Horn is the John J. and Rebecca Moore's Chair of History and African American Studies at the University of Houston, and the author of many books. And could you talk about your latest book? What is the name of the latest one that you come out with so many books? I can't even keep up, sir.
The Dawning of the Apocalypse, The Roots of Slavery, White Supremacy, Settler Colonialism, and Capitalism in the Long 16th Century. Tell me that you've received your copy.
No, sir. I have. I went out on Friday to my mailbox, and it was not there. I think we are having my sister tried to send me something, and it took a longer time. I think this pandemic has something to do with the pandemic, and also has something to do with if you were sending me a book about Daffy Duck or Mickey Mouse, probably would have come. But the book that you're sending me is talking about the struggle of African and all oppressed people. And, you know, I think the Postal Service might, I know I'll get it, but I guess they're going to make sure that maybe they read it first or whatever they want to do with it first.
I see. Hey, so tell me about Balarama Wholeness, the budding Canadian politician of Jamaican ancestry who's being touted as the next and forthcoming Prime Minister of Canada.
Well, first of all, the name Wholeness is, I think the current Prime Minister of Jamaica is a Wholeness.
That's true. And
I didn't know that. And I know another sister by the name of Jennifer Wholeness. Jennifer Wholeness is married to a great filmmaker. Well, she's a great filmmaker herself. But Jennifer Wholeness is married to Richard Sutherland. And the Wholeness is JLP, if I'm not mistaken. He's labor right, isn't he?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, well, okay, the labor right for the people that labor right would be like a Republican in American politics, or like a conservative in American politics. He would be a Republican in Canadian politics. He would be a conservative. But I didn't know that they were related. But he is coming out of a Montreal. And he played with, I think he played with another Canadian team before, Winnipeg, but then he played for the Montreal Alouettes. And the Montreal Alouettes also had a quarterback for a long time from Los Angeles, Anthony Calveo. I might be mispronouncing his name. But I think at this brother, Chicano brother from Los Angeles, he might have played in the league for maybe 20 years. He has all of the records, many of the records. Between he and Warren Moon, another Los Angeles person, he was the man. And anyway, Wholeness was not bragging, but he was talking about how he was injured and he wanted to come back, and he used some of his not necessarily, well, it was partly spiritual, but a lot of it was based on, as far as I could see, a little science. It wasn't all mysticism. And he basically came back and played football and won the Grey Cup, which is the Grey Cup is like the Canadian Super Bowl. And in terms of that, that's basically all I know about him. And you sent me the article, was in the New York Times. It looked like was it the Los Angeles Times or New York Times?
It's New York Times. Yeah.
New York Times. And they made him look pretty good. But I don't know that, to be honest with you, I don't know that much about him as an individual.
It looks like he's Montreal based, so he's very actively locally in Montreal. Basically sort of, they had a coalition, doing things around anti-blackness within the city hall. So, to be honest, I haven't heard of him, but yeah, New York Times is naming him the next Canadian, Barack Obama. So definitely it's somebody to watch, I guess.
But what party is he affiliated with?
It doesn't, I have no idea. This is the first time I'm hearing about him, but it doesn't say his political, he's looking very liberal though. So that would be my guess.
Mm-hmm. And interestingly enough, his ancestry is mixed, and apparently his religious background is mixed, because his first name is South Asian, Hindu, and apparently his Jamaican relatives somehow were Hindu.
Oh, interesting.
That's
well,
in
the hint, I'll cut you off. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
No, I say, well, in terms of the Jamaican situation is so fluid in terms of the religion. Jamaica is a as you know, has so many different forms of religion. I mean, you have a substantial amount of East Indians there, and many East Indians maintain some of their culture. So I think that's probably part of it. I think it's a brother by the name of Supercat. He is a Indian ancestry, but I think I remember interviewing him, and he told me that he was from Ethiopia, and I remember I kind of sarcastically said, well, you know, how did they get from Ethiopia to West Africa, then were taken to the West? And he had some kind of answer for that, but Jamaica the Caribbean is, as you know, it's Trinidad would be Trinidad, Guyana, and all of that have a mixture of all the religions, you know, including the religion that people don't, the religions that people never talk about is the religion of the Tainos. And the Arawaks, you know, they also had a religion too before the Europeans came.
True that.
And what else? Is there anything else you had to add on that question?
No, I just found it fascinating that he's receiving all this publicity. And apparently he was a good athlete. I mean, according to that New York Times article.
He was top shelf. Yeah, he was no joke when it came to playing ball. And you know the Montreal Alouettes, that's the same team that John Carlos played for the Alouettes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, John Carlos and the Canadian football team had Canadian Football League. Warren Moon played for many, 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 many years in, as you know, in the Canadian Football League. And there was a brother by the name of John Henry Jackson. He was out of Georgia. I think he might have been the first black quarterback. He had to come to Canada and play quarterback. But he was a quarterback for a couple of teams in Canada, I think. Before there was a Toronto Argonauts, they had a different name, and John Henry Jackson started a soul food restaurant called the Underground Railroad He was partners with Bill Cosby, and I forgot the Dave Mann. Do you remember Dave Mann? He was Huey Newton. He was a Canadian football player, but he was related to Huey P. Newton. I think he might have been a punt returner. And they started a restaurant along with a guy by the name of Archie Allen, who was a drummer who played with Billie Holiday, so on and so forth. And that is part of the history of African people in Toronto and in Canada. And the CFL, when you were coming up, did you pay that much attention to the CFL? Or I guess all eyes were on the NFL, the National Football League.
Well, occasionally. I can't say that I was a close student, but I was familiar for sure.
Mm-hmm. I guess Warren Moon, he made a lot of so much noise. I guess people had to relate to him, had to pay attention to what he was doing, correct?
Sure, of course.
He won several great cups and so on and so forth, yeah. And you are listening to Diasporic Music on Black Power 96, and we are in fundraising mode. And I'd like to ask you, Dr. Horn, why should people support Diasporic Music on Black Power 96?
Well, I think that should be obvious and evident. The fact is that the kind of music, the kind of information you receive this outlet is wholly unique. It's difficult, if not impossible, to duplicate. And that's why I'm asking anyone within range of my voice to go to your secure website and make a secure pledge, or to pick up the phone and dial the following number.
Oh, there's no one on the phone, sir, so appreciate you.
Go to our computer and type in blackpower96.org/donate, and any amount counts.
Okay, very good.
Now, wanted to concern.
Well, as I said, I mean, when I talked to you recently, I had mentioned that the U.S. president, apparently, according to Mr. Bolton, is not very fond of the Canadian Prime Minister, which I think helps to explain why he did not come to the meeting with the President of Mexico and the President of the United States just a few days ago in Washington to sign the pact initiating the sequel to NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Association. Apparently, he's not very fond of President Macron of France either. Recall their first meeting where Mr. Macron gave him this overly firm handshake as if it were some sort of macho contest. And you could see the veins popping into Mr. Trump's neck as he was trying to hold on and not trying to withdraw from that iron grip first, as Mr. Macron smiled like a Cheshire cat at him. According to this Bolton book, Mr. Trump is also not very fond of Chancellor Merkel of Germany, and in fact, supposedly at a meeting, threw something at her. So what's interesting, however, is that this is happening at the same time that the North American countries are trying to unite to confront China. But given Mr. Trump's ham-fisted approach to foreign policy as represented by what I just articulated, it's not going to be easy, although it won't be impossible, because obviously, the North Atlantic countries have an interest in trying to stop China's rise. I think that's one of the reasons why you have these U.S. battleships as we speak off the coast of China. Imagine if U.S. battleships were off the, excuse me, if Chinese battleships were off the coast of British Columbia or Southern California, for example. And also, Mr. Bolton says quite intriguingly that he feels that the Secretary of the Treasury, Steve Mnuchin, is basically in China's pocket. He suggests that the same holds true for Mr. Trump's brother-in-law, Jared Kushner. Now, he doesn't say the same holds true for Henry Kissinger, who's made a small fortune. It's very typical U.S. style. He helped to engineer the new relationship with China in the 1970s. Then he left office and made his fortune introducing U.S. businessmen to Chinese leaders so they could open factories and the like in China. And then he took a cut. Now, what's interesting is that, in case you hadn't noticed, those three men that I just mentioned, Mnuchin, Kushner, and Kissinger, are all Jewish. Now, of course, if I had written what Mr. Bolton had written, I'd be called all kinds of anti-Semite. I mean, they probably try to fire me, you know, whatever. That would have probably been the worst that could happen, in fact, or the best that could happen, excuse me. So it's a very interesting book. I mean, I wouldn't necessarily recommend buying it, but I think if you're interested in U.S. policy towards Japan, China, the European Union, Canada, if you're interested in U.S. imperialist policy and how it's constructed in the White House, if you're interested in U.S. policy towards Cuba, Venezuela, and Iran, I would say you should take a look at it. There's hardly any references at all to Africa, except for Mr. Trump giving a shout out to the European farmers in South Africa and offering them asylum in case they get into hot water with the government in Pretoria. Mr. Trump apparently is not fond of AFRICOM, the African command, the Pentagon military infrastructure in Africa, which is good news if it's true. But Mr. Bolton also tries to, as they say colloquially, try to start some mess. For example, at a couple of points, he says that Russia is very suspicious of China. Now, the contemporaneous record does not support that novel idea. And I think he put that in the book just to start some mess between Beijing and Moscow and make them suspicious of each other. But that's just speculation on my part.
Well, what is, could you talk about China as we speak? You know, how should African people and oppressed people look at China? You know, there's an element of a Black America and an element of some people on in the Caribbean and in Africa. But I think the Rwandans threw the Chinese out. What are your thoughts on China's role in Africa and in the Caribbean in 2020?
Well, I mean, I think we have to look at this from different angles. I think in Africa and the Caribbean, I think most of the leadership there welcomes the Chinese because it provides an alternative to the North Atlantic bloc, which heretofore has been dominant. And of course, these Black Americans, it's just like Clarence, you can always depend upon the Black Americans ultimately to go along with U.S. imperialism, I'm afraid to say, for the most part. Of course, there are exceptions. But just like many of the Black Americans, they went along with the anti-Soviet line during the Cold War. They found an excuse to do so. Now many of them are finding an excuse to go along with the anti-Chinese line. Apparently, it's because of China's role in Africa, although generally speaking, you don't hear the African leaders complaining. As noted, they're looking for a counterweight. But in any case, we talked about this many times. China has a lot to apologize for. I mean, it played a dastardly role in Southern Africa during the liberation struggles. I talked about that in my book. And, you know, the reason it got to this high level is because it collaborated with U.S. imperialism, as I just indicated with the Henry Kissinger deal. But I think it's backfired. You know, in my 16th century book, I talk about how the Ottoman Turks, who I think generally speaking, it's fair to say they were probably the dominant power, at least in the European, African, and Asian theater in the 16th century. And they didn't take this monarchy on the fringes of Europe, speaking of England, very seriously. And so they collaborated with that monarchy in order to destabilize who they thought was the chief power, which was the Catholics in Spain, who of course sponsored Columbus and then encountered the Americas and got fat and rich in the process by plundering the Americas. But that collaboration with England backfired. As we all know, that's one of the reasons we're speaking English as we speak and not Turkish. And I dare say that that alliance with China, that the revolting spawn of England pulled off, speaking of the United States in the 1970s, is also backfiring. So it's rather ironic, would you not say?
You have a question, Melinda?
I guess maybe more update about the pandemic right now, and where, you know, the U.S. is sitting right now.
Well, you know, I'm speaking to you from what might be the new epicenter, which is Texas. As I was saying before we went on air, the pandemic and coronavirus is so thick down here, you can almost see the virus in the air. I mean, which is rather ironic, again, because hundreds of years ago, you had these parasites from Europe and invaded this part of North America and inserted themselves into the host, which is the Native American population, and plundered and pillaged them. And now you have these microbes invading, inserting themselves into many of the descendants of that original parasite, speaking of these European settlers. But it's also spreading in Africa. South Africa had record numbers of infection cases just as of a day or two ago. So this is a very serious matter. But what's interesting is that because the virus is out of control, United States, 134,000 people have died, whereas, say, in Hong Kong, which admittedly is only 7 million people, the number of deaths have been basically in the double digits. And as a result, you've seen that not only have European countries tried to bar the entrance of U.S. citizens with their alleged valuable blue passport, the same holds true for Mexico in a turnabout, trying to bar the arrival of U.S. nationals. India, Brazil, Russia also have very high case loads as well. So this is a very serious matter, and it's unclear how it will eventuate.
And we're speaking with Dr. Gerald Horn. And the next question I want to ask you is the Nile Dam role, talking about the Nile River. Can you talk about Egypt and Ethiopia and the whole question of generating heat but no power?
Oh, I see. Well, as you suggested, Ethiopia is building a dam on the Nile River, and Egypt is objecting because it feels that this dam, which costs almost $5 billion and is designed to deliver electricity to Ethiopia, which has one of the fastest growing economies in Africa and on planet Earth, the Egyptians say that this is challenging their access to the Nile River. I don't think that there is a danger that the two countries will go to war, but there have been some rather inflamed rhetoric, shall we say, on both sides. And what's striking as well is that it could not come at a worse time. Ethiopia, as you know, is facing this conflict with its largest ethnic group, speaking of the Oromo. There are problems with neighboring Somalia, which hasn't had a truly functioning government in decades now. And what's interesting about that is that you also have to take into account the role of Turkey. Turkey is really reasserting itself in that part of Africa. It's probably the major force in Somalia, doing everything from garbage collection to running the airport. And as well, it's Turkey that has helped to rescue the off-challenge government in Tripoli, Libya, which had been under threat by a force from Benghazi, the number two city in Libya, that had been backed, among others, by Egypt and Russia and France. And so now Egypt is threatening to confront Turkey and their ally in Tripoli. And then you have the problem of Djibouti, which not only has a U.S. base, but a Chinese base, a French base, a Japanese base even. And of course, it's very important to the Ethiopian economy. So this is a very complex situation. Hopefully cooler heads will prevail. But in any case, I trust that listeners will stay tuned.
Could I ask you the history, not the history, but could you talk about the differences between Gamal Abdel Nasser when he ran Egypt, and His Imperial Majesty Haile Selassie, when he was the head of state of Ethiopia. I remember, and I hope I'm saying the right thing. I believe Carlos Cooks was a fan of Gamal Abdel Nasser, and he was not fond of His Imperial Majesty, and he was not a fan of Liberia. He claimed that the American Negroes, the Barbadians, and other Uncle Toms were running Liberia, and he bigged up Gamal Abdel Nasser. Could you talk about, you know, that situation?
Well, with regard to Liberia in West Africa, which was initiated by the settler colonialists in the United States in the first few decades of the 19th century, and with the aim of sending all the free U.S. Negroes there, the role of the free U.S. Negroes in Liberia was not very pretty, which led, as you know, in 1980 to an eruption by the indigenous Africans. And you can go on YouTube as we speak and see a picture of these descendants in 1980 of the U.S. Negroes being lined up along a beach in Liberia and being mowed down systematically. Now, I wouldn't recommend watching that video unless you have a very strong stomach. But in any case, the signal difference between Nasser in Cairo and His Imperial Majesty in Addis Ababa is that the latter was supposedly part of a royal family with lineage, you're told, stretching back to Solomon and Sheba, whereas Nasser was a former military officer who, in the early 1950s, organizes a movement that dispatches King Farouk and then, of course, becomes a very popular leader, not only in Egypt and the Arab world, but to a certain degree in Black America as well.
I mean, I think Malcolm X always bigged up Gamal Abdel Nasser. And I know one of my best friends, one of the first people that came from the United States, you know, resisting the draft, he changed his name to Gamil. I guess Gamil was Nasser was next to Christ in many circles, I guess, in Black America, wouldn't you say?
Well, sure, and for good reason. I mean, he had his hands full. I mean, he was confronting Israel. I'm sure you recall the Six-Day War, so-called.
Yes.
Where Israel emerged triumphant in 1967. He had his hands full confronting U.S. imperialism. It was a very difficult situation that he faced. And I think the telling aspect is when he dies, you might even be able to find this online, too. You had thousands of people in the streets in Egypt crying, weeping unashamedly. You rarely see that with regard to the death of a political leader nowadays.
Is there anything else you'd like to add, sir?
No, that's about it, I guess.
All right, so we are in fundraising mode. So, Melinda, you want to give that information for the final time?
To donate, please donate to our member. We have this every July. I think we're trying to raise $6,000 for the station, $300 for the show. So go to your computer and type in blackpower96.org/donate. Any amount counts. If you get anything over $20, you get an awesome mask. So go to your computers and donate now.
Thank you. And I would like to Gerald, I just put up a piece on Facebook where Lee Morgan played with Oscar Peterson for the CBC. And Ed Thickpen was the drummer. And Ed Thickpen is from Thomas Jefferson High School in Los Angeles, California. And as you know, Thomas Jefferson High School is the school that produced Ralph Bunch, Dorothy Dandridge, Alvin Ailey, Barry White, Roy Ayers. It has a rich tradition of producing entertainers as well as political figures. But did you ever see Lee Morgan perform live?
Afraid not.
I never saw him either. So
I just want to announce. Thank you to one listener who anonymously donated $150. We greatly appreciate it, and keep it coming.
Yeah, thank you. Whoever the anonymous human being is, as they say in Swahili, Santa Sana, I thank you very, very much. I guess until next week, we will see everybody in the whirlwind. So thank Lisa Watson for her technical brilliance as usual. And we will see you in the whirlwind.
Good luck.